This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Happy, 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 My Life and Legacy as the Duck Commander by Phil Robertson. Read by Al Robertson and introduced by the author.
Prologue. Happy, happy, happy. When A&E TV approached us about doing a reality TV show based on our family, I was somewhat reluctant and wasn't quite sure if it would work. Let me take a guess here, I told the producers. I told them that there was probably a boardroom meeting at the A&E headquarters in New York City, where all the suits, yuppies, and best creative minds were kicking around ideas for a new reality TV show. At some point during the meeting, someone probably spoke up and said, Bob, I know this might sound weird, but why don't we try portraying a functional American family? And I'm sure the guy sitting across the table shouted, now that's a novel idea. Everything else on TV nowadays is dysfunctional, and for the most part has been that way for 40 years. The last TV shows we saw that featured functional families were The Andy Griffith Show, The Waltons, The Beverly Hillbillies, Don't Laugh, and Little House on the Prairie. That was a long time ago. I'm sure someone else in the A&E board meeting probably then asked, Bob, where do we find a functional family in America? For whatever reason, they looked for one in West Monroe, Louisiana. To be honest, our family isn't much different from other families in America. There's a mom and a dad, 4 grown kids, 14 grandchildren, and a couple of great-grandkids. We started a family business, Duck Commander, which turned into a pretty lucrative enterprise with a lot of elbow grease, teamwork, and God's blessings. But as you'll find out by listening to this book, we've had our share of trials and struggles like a lot of other families. We've battled alcohol and drug abuse, sibling rivalries, and near poverty and despair at the beginning of our time together as a family. It wasn't always like what you see on TV. So except for our very manly appearances, it might not seem that we're all that different from anyone else. But I think what separates the Robertsons from a lot of other families is our faith in God and love for each other. It's unconditional. And it has been that way for as long as I can remember. For me, the most dramatic part of every Duck Dynasty episode comes at the end when our family gathers around the dinner table to eat one of Miss Kay's home-cooked meals. You don't see families gathering up like that anymore. Everybody in America is so busy, busy, busy. Americans are too preoccupied with their cell phones and computers, so they don't take the time to sit down with their spouses, children, grandchildren, aunts and uncles, and grandparents to eat a meal together. The family structure is slipping away from America, but not in our house. Thomas Jefferson, the 3rd president of the United States, probably said it best. Shortly after our founding fathers left the large cities of Europe for the wide open spaces of America, Jefferson said of the American people, when they get piled upon one another in large cities as in Europe, they will become corrupt as in Europe. You'll never find me living in a city, folks. Where I live, I am 911. Like I say, if you spend too much time in the subdivision, you go a-running when the snakes fall out of trees. The other problem in America today is that the young girls don't know how to cook. Their grandmothers and mamas cook for them, but they never took the time to learn how to cook. They were more interested in other things. If you go out into the subdivisions and suburbs of America where all of the yuppies live, you'll see the restaurants are packed with people. They don't want to eat slop and they're looking for good food, but they don't want to take the time to make it. Dad is working, Mom is working, and so no one has the time or energy to cook a good meal anymore. So our families end up eating in restaurants where they're surrounded by noise and clutter instead of sharing quality time in a family setting. When I reluctantly agreed to be a part of Duck Dynasty, The producers told me they were going to make a reality show without duck hunting. I asked them if they understood that I spend most of my waking hours in a duck blind or in the woods. There isn't much else I do. I asked the producers, you know, you're dealing with a bunch of rednecks who duck hunt. For the life of me, do you really think this is going to work? Ozzy Osbourne made it, they told me. Ozzy was able to pull it off on reality TV, so he's given hope to all of us. I had never really watched many reality TV shows and knew nothing about them, but I was 100% convinced Duck Dynasty would never work. It just goes to show how little I know about today's world because I was dead wrong. For the life of me, I can't figure out why people are so attracted to our family. Maybe it's because we live our lives like people really want to live, how we all used to live before everything got so busy, busy, busy. Duck Dynasty has made us a little bit more famous, but it hasn't changed much of anything about us. Miss Kay and I still live in the same house on the Washita River outside of West Monroe, and I'm still driving the same truck and hunting with the same guns and dogs. Of course, we still go to church every Sunday morning, and I'm still reading my Bible. If anything has changed, it's that it's a little more difficult to go places, like driving down an interstate or walking through an airport. If I'm driving somewhere, someone might drive by and recognize me, undoubtedly because of my beard. They'll get on a cell phone and call their friends, and then when I stop to take a leak, I'll have to sign autographs and pose for pictures for about 30 minutes. When we went duck hunting in Arkansas recently, we stopped at a Walmart to buy our out-of-state hunting licenses. We were in the sporting goods section of the store when some people recognized us, so we started posing for pictures and signing T-shirts. When it was finally time for us to leave, three African-American girls approached us. "Well, girls, I didn't know you soul sisters were duck hunters," I told them. "We don't care about no ducks," one of them said. "You're ZZ Top, ain't you?" I guess not everyone in America watches Duck Dynasty. Miss Kay and I haven't done too badly, and the good Lord has really blessed us. We've been married nearly 50 years, and our boys have grown up to become loving husbands and fathers, the kind of men I wanted them to be. Our business is in good shape, even after I had my doubts about where it was going. But when the boys took over, they breathed new life into it, and it's still growing. Not many are as fortunate as we are, with all the trouble in the world. Since I turned over the reins of my company to my sons, I keep busy with hunting and fishing and speaking engagements. God provided those. The appearances give me an opportunity to preach the gospel, which I feel compelled to do. I've also had a chance to learn from all the people I've met and the chance to travel all over the country. I hope I've helped those who have heard the gospel. Where do I go from here? The time is near when the dust will return to the earth and the Spirit to God who gave it. I'm ready for that, but not quite yet. I have a lot of speeches to give, a lot of blinds to build, a lot of Duck Dynasty episodes to make, and who knows how many more duck seasons to hunt. Maybe the greatest thing is that I've been able to live life the way I wanted. Following Jesus has been a blast. The Lord has blessed me mightily. It is what makes me happy, happy, happy. And now I pass it on to my son Al.
Chapter 1. Low-Tech Man. Rule number 1 for living happy, happy, happy. Simplify your life. Throw away your cell phones and computers, yuppies. Whatever happened to the on and off switch? I don't ask for much, but my hope is that someday soon we'll get back to where we have a switch that says on and off. Nowadays, everything has a passcode, a sequence, or a secret decoder. I think maybe the yuppies overdid it with these computers. The very thing they touted as the greatest time-saving device in history, a computer, now occupies the lion's share of everybody's life. Here's a perfect example. I owned a Toyota Tundra for a while, and I got tired of driving around with my headlights on all the time. If I'm driving around in the woods and it's late in the evening, I don't want my headlights on. I tried to turn the lights off and couldn't do it. I spent an hour inside the truck with a friend of mine trying to turn off the lights, but we never figured it out. So I called the car dealer, and he told me to look in the owner's manual. Well, it wasn't in the book, which is about as thick as a Bible. Finally, about 10 days later, after my buddy spent some time with a bunch of young bucks in town driving Toyota trucks, he told me he had the code for turning off my lights. Now get this. First, you have to shut off the truck's engine. Then you have to step on the emergency brake with your left foot until you hear one click. Not two clicks, only one. If you hear two clicks, you have to bring the brake back up and start all over. After you hear one click, you crank the engine back up. I sat there thinking, why would you possibly need a code for turning off headlights? What kind of mad scientist came up with that sequence? Seriously, what kind of mind designed something like that? To me, it's not logical. I just don't get it. But that's where we are in today's world. I miss the times when life was simple. I came from humble, humble beginnings. When I was a young boy growing up in the far northwest corner of Louisiana, only about 6 miles from Texas and 10 miles from Arkansas, we didn't have very much in terms of personal possessions. But even when times were the hardest, I never once heard my parents, brothers, or sisters utter the words, "Boy, we're dirt poor." We never had new cars, nice clothes, or much money, and we certainly never lived in an extravagant home, but we were always happy, 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 no matter the circumstances. My daddy, James Robertson, was that kind of guy. He didn't care about all the frills in life. He was perfectly content with what we had, and so were we. We were a self-contained family, eating the fruits and vegetables that grew in our garden, or what the Almighty provided us in other ways. And, of course, when we were really lucky, we had meat from the deer, squirrels, fish, and other game my brothers and I hunted and fished in the areas around our home, along with the pigs, chickens, and cattle we raised on our farm. It was the 1950s when I was a young boy, but we lived about like it was the 1850s. My daddy always reminded us that when he was a boy, his family would go to town and load the wagon down and return home with a month's worth of necessities. For only $5, they could buy enough flour, salt, pepper, sugar, and other essentials to survive for weeks. We rarely went to town for groceries, probably because we seldom had $5 to spend, let alone enough gas to get there. I grew up in a little log cabin in the woods, and it was located far from Yuppieville. The cabin was built near the turn of the 20th century and was originally a three-room shotgun house. At some point, someone added a small, protruding shed room off the southwest corner of the house. The room had a door connecting to the main room, which is where the fireplace was located. I guess whoever added the room thought it would be warmest near the fireplace, which was the only source of heat in our house. In hindsight, it really didn't make a difference where you put the room if you didn't insulate or finish the interior walls. It was going to be cold in there no matter what. I slept in the shed with my three older brothers, Jimmy Frank, the oldest, who was 10 years older than me, Harold, who was 6 years older than me, and Tommy, who was 2 years older than me. I never thought twice about sleeping with my three brothers in a bed. I thought that's what everybody did. My younger brother, Silas, slept in the main room on the west end of the house because he had a tendency to wet the bed. My older sister, Judy, also slept in that room. I can still remember trying to sleep in that room during the winter. There were a lot of sleepless nights. The overlapping boards on the exterior walls of the house were barely strong enough to block the wind, and they sure didn't stand a chance against freezing temperatures. The shed room was about 10 square feet, and its only furnishings were a standard bed and a battered chest of drawers. My brothers and I kept a few pictures, keepsakes, and whatnots on the 2x4 cross pieces on the framing of the interior walls. Every night before bed, we unloaded whatever was in our pockets, usually a fistful of marbles and whatever else we had found that day, on the cross pieces and then reloaded our pockets again the next morning. To help battle the cold, my brothers and I layered each other in heavy homemade quilts on the bed. Jimmy Frank and Harold were the biggest, so they slept on opposite sides of the bed, with Tommy and me sleeping in between them. My daddy and my mother, Merritt Robertson, we started calling them Granny and Pa when our children were born, slept in a small middle room in the house. My youngest sister, Jan, was the baby of the family and slept in a crib next to my parents' bed until she was old enough to sleep with Judy. The fireplace in the west room was the only place to get warm. It was made of the natural red stone of the area and was rather large. One of my brothers once joked that it was big enough to burn up a wet mule. Because the fireplace was the only source of heat in the home, it was my family's gathering spot. Every morning in the winter, the first person out of bed, it always seemed to be Harold, was responsible for starting a fire. It would usually reignite with pine fatwood kindling, but sometimes you had to blow the coals to stoke the flames. Some of my favorite memories as a child were when we baked potatoes and roasted hickory nuts on the fireplace coals for snacks. We usually ate them with some of my mother's homemade dill pickles. There was never any candy or junk food in our house. The only other room in the cabin was a combination kitchen and dining area. The cook stove was fueled by natural gas from a well that was located down the hill and across the creek. The pressure from the well was so low that it barely produced enough gas to cook. Pa always said we were lucky to have the luxury of running water in the house, even if it was only cold water coming through a 1-inch pipe from a hand-dug well to the kitchen sink. We didn't even have a bathtub or commode in the house. The water pipeline habitually froze during the winter, and my brothers and I spent many mornings unfreezing the pipe with hot coals from the fire. When the pipe was frozen, we'd grab a shovel full of coals and place them on the ground under the pipe. When we finally heard gurgling and then water spitting out of the kitchen sink, we knew we could return to the fire to get warm again. Breakfast began when Granny put a big pot of water on the stove to heat. We didn't have a hot water heater, so we bathed in cold water when I was young. Granny used the hot water for cooking and cleaning the dishes. Breakfast usually consisted of hot buttermilk biscuits, blindfolded fried eggs, butter, and fresh sweet milk. Every morning, one of my brothers or I would take a pail of hot water to the barn to clean the cow's udders after we milked them. There were always several jars of jams and jellies on our table. Pa and Granny canned them from wild fruits that grew in abundance in the Arklatex area. Pa liked to scold us for having too many jars open at once. He said we opened them just to hear the ball jar lids pop. He may have been right. Nearly everything we ate came from our land. The eggs came from our chickens, the milk and butter from our cows. Bacon and sausage came from the hogs we raised and butchered. We canned vegetables from our large garden, which spread over about 8 acres in 3 different patches. Cucumbers were turned into jars and jars of sweet, sour bread and butter and dill pickles. Our pantry shelves were lined with canned tomatoes, peppers, beets, and just about anything else my family grew, including pears, peaches, plums, and grapes, as well as the abundant dewberries and blackberries of the area. Cut-up cabbage, green tomatoes, onions, and peppers were mixed together and canned to make what we called chow chow, a relish that was a delicious accompaniment to just about anything, especially fish. In addition to our garden, where we also grew such things as English peas, butter, and pole beans, lettuce, turnips, mustard greens, onions, radishes, carrots, Irish and sweet potatoes, cantaloupes, and watermelons, my family grew several fields of peas, peanuts, and corn. We started many of the vegetables from seeds that were planted in a hotbed, called a cold frame by some, in early February. My brothers and I gathered cow and horse manure, which, as it decomposed, kept the bed warm and enriched the soil. After the plants sprouted and grew big enough, we transferred them to the garden. One year, Pa, figuring he would get a jump on the market for the early watermelons that brought the highest prices, had my brothers and I collect manure from the cow pens to put into 200 holes. He directed us to dig the holes 2 feet square and 2 feet deep. In early February, Jimmy, Frank, and Harold laboriously filled washtub after washtub with manure and then transported them on a slide pulled by an old mule to the holes that were dug. After depositing the manure into the holes, we mixed the top of it with soil and planted the watermelon seeds. To be perfectly honest, Tommy and I didn't become too interested in the project until Jimmy, Frank, and Harold told us we should plant marbles, along with the watermelon seeds, in the holes. They promised us we would grow a big crop of marbles. Of course, we were young enough and thus gullible enough to believe them. We already had marbles running out our ears from ill-gotten gains at the schoolyard, where we played bullseye, cat's eye, and hot box for keeps, Whoever shot best and won the other's marbles got to keep them. We won regularly and often came home with pockets bulging with marbles, which we deposited in a 5-gallon bucket just inside the back door. Tommy and I grabbed our bucket and with high hopes planted them in the manure just like our older brothers told us to do. It didn't take Tommy or me too long to realize we had been duped. We ended up sacrificing ammunition for our slingshots for a bumper crop that never came. There were always two things in my pocket when I was young, marbles and a slingshot. We made our slingshots from forked tree limbs and red, real rubber bands we cut from old inner tubes. The black synthetic inner tubes didn't have the necessary snap to propel a marble or small rock. We used the slingshots to bring down small birds, but Granny and my grandmother always admonished us not to shoot the mockingbirds, or redbirds, as they call cardinals. Our watermelons came up beautifully that year. The decaying manure heated the beds enough to sprout the seeds early, and the soil's added richness gave the young watermelon plants a tremendous growth spurt that turned the hillside where they were growing into a couple of acres of lush, verdant green vines. Pa never followed up on selling them, so we wound up giving away what we didn't eat to kinfolk and friends. My entire family took part in harvesting fruits and vegetables. If we hadn't, we wouldn't have had enough to eat. From the beginning of May, when the mayhaws and dewberries ripened, until the end of fall, with the gathering of muscadines and pears, my family and I could regularly be found in the area's swamps, fields, forests, and abandoned home sites. With our buckets and tubs, from the youngest to the oldest, we would be stooped over or stretched upward gathering whatever fruit was in season. Pa, who worked on drilling rigs usually located in the wilds, often discovered fruit trees and berry and grapevines as he moved about with the rigs. He also knew the locations of many old home sites with abandoned peach orchards, grapevines, and plum and pear trees. There was no shortage of places to harvest. The trick was to get there when the fruit was ripe and before another family beat you to it. I remember one particularly cold, wet spring when my family was wading ankle deep in our everyday shoes because we didn't have rubber boots to gather mayhaws in cottonmouth-infested waters near Myrtis, Louisiana, in a swampy area off Black Bayou. Clouds of mosquitoes covered our backs, biting through our thin shirts while we stooped to gather the floating fruit we shook from thickly clustered trees. Mayhaw jelly is still my favorite, and even today my wife Kay and I gather the bright reddish-orange berries from the swamps around our home each spring. We make plenty of the tart jelly for our needs, usually with enough left over for our children and other family members and friends. Mayhaw jelly has a unique, delicious flavor. One year when I was young, the wild grapes were so abundant in the old Ruby Florence field that they filled all of our tubs and buckets with rich, purple-red fruit. We could barely fit our harvest into the car, which was already crowded with adults and children. In fact, the trunk was so crammed full of tubs and buckets of fruit piled on top of each other that the lid wouldn't shut. Several large buckets and pans of grapes were jammed inside the car on the floorboards between our legs and on our laps. The harvest was so great that Granny lit all four burners on the stove and had Pa and Jimmy Frank set an entire No. 3 washtub full of grapes on top of them to render the juice. As our luck would have it, this was also one of the years when the price of sugar was sky high, always a consideration in canning as to whether it was worth the cost. After making a smaller amount of jelly than usual, my family simply sealed a number of gallons of surplus grape juice in quart jars without sugar and stored them in the cabinets alongside and beneath the sink, thinking we might make jelly later after the price of sugar went down. But we eventually found that the stored juice was delicious, so my brothers and I drank a quart or more daily for breakfast and snacks. Before too long, the juice began to ferment. In only a short time, it turned into a very good wine. My parents and older relatives began to drink this, too, but couldn't finish it before it turned into vinegar. Granny used the vinegar in her canning throughout the rest of the year. Of course, man can't survive on fruits and vegetables alone, at least not a real man, so we also raised and butchered our own beef, usually killing 2 steer calves annually that weighed about 400 pounds each. The calves were the offspring of our milk cows, which were bred to my Aunt Myrtle's beef-type bull, a runty, mostly black Angus mix which still sired nice calves. Paul and my older brothers would kill the calf, gut and skin it, and wrap it in an old bedsheet, which they put into the trunk of our car. We didn't have a deep freezer, so the meat was taken to Vivian, Louisiana, about 2 miles away, where it was hung to cool and age in a local ice house. After about 14 days, Paul brought the sides of beef home and cut them up on the dining table. Then Granny and Paul wrapped the meat in freezer paper and took it to a rental storage locker in town, where it was frozen. Granny periodically retrieved packages of beef when she was in town and transferred them to the small freezing compartment in the refrigerator at home. Homegrown chickens were another staple at my house when I was a boy. Paul bought 200 baby chicks by mail order each year at a cost of about $5 per 100, 100 early and another 100 later, so we always had young fryers running around the yard. It was a big day when the baby chicks were brought home from the post office in a ventilated cardboard box. They were immediately moved into a brooder Jimmy Frank built with 4x8-foot sheets of tin. The brooder was heated by using an old wash tub with vents on the sides and a small burner that was fueled by the natural gas well that also heated the stove. We didn't wait too long to start eating the chickens, even if it took 8 of them to make a meal. We usually kept 20 or so hens every year to lay eggs, and we dined on the older ones from previous years during the winter. Of course, we cooked and prepared them the old-fashioned way, wringing their necks, plucking the feathers, and singeing them over a stove burner. Our Sunday meals in the spring and summer typically consisted of fried chicken and homemade ice cream, which was made with the rich cream of our Jersey cows. On the way home from church, we'd pick up a 25-pound block of ice, and my brothers and I would make the ice cream outside. Jimmy Frank or Harold cranked the freezer while Tommy or I sat on it to keep it steady. The story of the Robertson family is a pretty good picture of an early American family. We didn't have much, but we loved each other and found ways to keep each other entertained. We didn't have cell phones or computers, but somehow we managed to survive. As far as I know, none of my brothers or sisters has ever owned a cell phone, and Jimmy Frank is the only one who owns a computer because he's a newspaper man and needs one to write his stories. I've never owned a cell phone and don't plan on ever having one. I've never owned a computer, and I'm still trying to figure out what the fuss over social media is all about. I can promise you one thing, you'll never find me on Twitter or Skype. If anyone needs to talk to me, they know where I live. Chapter 2, Great Outdoors. Rule number 2 for living happy, happy, happy. Don't let your grandkids grow up to be nerds. The Boy Scouts might have the motto, be prepared, but where I grew up, you practically went straight from diapers to manhood. You had to be prepared for anything. I learned to hunt and fish shortly after I learned to walk. If you couldn't shoot and kill something, chances were you weren't going to eat. If a hurricane had hit my boyhood home and wiped out everything, I would have found a way to survive, even when I was only 5 years old. I'm trying to teach those same lessons of survival to my grandchildren because the last thing I want is for them to grow up to be nerds. Let me tell you one thing. I don't see the inherent value in the video games that kids are playing today. But that's all these kids seem to want to do. Kids in America today are overweight and lazy, and it's their parents' fault for letting it happen. Kids sit around playing video games and eating junk food all day, and when they're not doing that, they're texting on their cell phones. It's only their fingers that are moving. They're not getting out and about. Have you ever seen a macho man walking around with a cell phone, mashing with his fingers and yakking on it all day? That's too much talking. By the time these kids are young adults, they're going to have to go to Walmart to buy a personality. Kids need to be out with nature, learning what it takes to survive in this world. When I was a very young boy, much of our food and sustenance came from the land around us. While living in Vivian, Louisiana, immediately following World War II and before we moved into the log cabin where I spent my formative years, Granny often told us, if we have another depression, we could live off this acre. The Great Depression was never far from my parents' thoughts. They suffered through the worst economic depression to ever hit the United States when they were younger. In those days, living off the land surrounding our house sounded feasible. Even on our limited acreage, we had a milk cow that was pastured on half the land and staked out alongside the road when grass was scarce. We had several fruit trees, which we'd planted, along with a large truck garden. It was called a truck garden because the overflow of what we raised in it was put on a truck and taken to town to sell, that provided abundantly from spring to fall. The garden yielded such food as turnips and greens far into the mild Louisiana winters. My great-aunt Willie Mae Irvins, who lived next door to us, kept a flock of chickens, and we purchased eggs and occasional young fryers and roasting hens from her. As a boy, living off the land influenced my outlook on life probably more than anything else, especially after I discovered an abundance of wild game and fish that was there for the taking in the area where we lived. I always had a conviction that I could survive off the land without being tied to a regular job. As I grew older, that belief influenced many of my decisions. I killed my first duck, actually two of them, when I was 11 years old. I was hunting on the bank of a small slough when three teal and a pintail flew close enough for me to shoot. I fired three times, bringing down the pintail and one teal. To this day, I can show you the exact spot where I shot those ducks. Remember what I said about being prepared? If I ever go back there, I'll be sure to take my dog or a boat, or at least some good waders. My first kill taught me a valuable lesson. Sometimes shooting the ducks isn't nearly as hard as retrieving them. With no retriever and no boat, the only way I could recover the birds was to take off my blue jeans and tattered shirt and wade into the icy water. I returned home with them and proudly announced to my father, "I have struck." As you might have noticed, I sometimes speak in dramatic terms if the occasion warrants it. It turned out the event was momentous. It shaped the rest of my life and absolutely convinced me I could live off the land. My father always lived by that philosophy and passed it on to my brothers and me. The son of Judge Ewan Robertson, longtime Vivian Justice of the Peace, Paul grew up a farm boy outside of town with two brothers and four sisters. He gravitated early to a career in the oil industry, which was booming with the fabulous East Texas and Pine Island discoveries, both classified as giant oil fields, practically at his doorstep. Paul served in the U.S. Navy at San Diego during World War II, achieving the rank of fireman first class. His familiarity with heavy pumps, which he gained in the oil fields, pointed him toward the repair base, where he fixed even bigger pumps used in warships. After returning home from the war, Paul bought a house on an acre of land just outside of Vivian with a federal homeowner's loan. It was a small A-frame house with two bedrooms located close to town and Highway 2. I was born at a clinic in Vivian on April 24, 1946. I was named after Granny's first cousin, Phil Shores, who was killed in World War II, and my great-grandfather, Lemuel Alexander Shores. My middle name is Alexander. I think much of my independent attitude was fostered by the fine example of Aunt Willie Mae next door. She was part of the original Robertson clan that moved to northwest Louisiana from Tennessee in a covered wagon in the late 1800s. In fact, there's a street in Nashville, James Robertson Parkway, that is named after one of my early ancestors. He was an explorer and companion of Daniel Boone and co-founded the city of Nashville. Willie Mae was 11 years old at the time and lived long enough to tell her grandchildren and numerous great-nieces and nephews about making the trip. Willie Mae's husband had been dead for many years before we moved next to her, but he left her with a few acres of land and a little money, which she used to build cabins she then rented out. With that income and more from boarders in two of the rooms in her home, and with a garden, chickens, and a milk cow, she made out pretty well. She often hired my siblings and me to weed her garden, mow her yard, and complete any other chores she could think up. We were paid with a shiny dime. She saved everyone she acquired and had a considerable hoard, which just so happened to be the price of admission to the picture show. Saturday afternoon trips to the double features at the local movie theater were about our only form of entertainment. We didn't have a TV, so we crowded around a radio near the fireplace to listen to Roy Rogers and Gene Autry. I'll never forget the opening monologue of Gunsmoke when the announcer would introduce The story of the violence that moved west with young America and the story of a man who moved with it. Then Marshal Matt Dillon, with his deep, resonant voice, would proclaim, "I'm that man, Matt Dillon, United States Marshal, the first man they look for and the last they want to meet." I used to love hearing those words. After a few years of living next door to Aunt Willie Mae, my mother began urging my father to move to a larger place outside of town. Granny grew up in the country and thought it would be easier to raise her family there. There were 6 kids in our family after my youngest brother Si was born, so we needed more space in the house, too. Her biggest concern was there was a busy paved highway that ran in front of our house, and my mama always worried one of her children would wander into traffic with the dangerous speed limit of 25 miles per hour. After one of my brothers was nearly hit by a speeding car, she ordered Pa to find us another place to live. Granny wanted to buy the old Douglas Waters place, a log home that sat on about 20 acres between Vivian and Houston, Louisiana. It was on the same road that ran in front of our old house, but the Waters home sat several hundred yards back, making it much safer for my siblings and me. But Pa wasn't interested in buying it, so we instead moved into a rental home in the middle of the Pine Island oil field. It was located 10 miles south of Vivian, and we had an oil well right in the middle of our front yard. The oil field ruined our water, which stained our commodes and sinks. The water smelled and tasted bad. Our drinking water came from a cistern made from an old oil field tank that collected water off the roof. It didn't take Granny and Pa long to realize we had to find somewhere else to live. About a year later, we ended up moving into a log home that used to be owned by the Waters family, the log home Granny had wanted to purchase all along, which was where I would spend my formative years and was the house I told you about earlier. My great-aunt Myrtle Goss bought the house because the place adjoined her 400 acres of land. We rented the house from her, and she put us in charge of tending to her 7 cows and bull, an old mule named Jake, and an equally old and stubborn horse named Dolly. She rented us the house and her 400 acres of land for the kinfolk price of $20 a month. Moving to that log home enabled my father to recapture his youth, which in turn shaped the lives of my brothers and me. The old Waters place had about 20 acres of land, only 10 of which, around the house, was cleared and tillable land. A creek that flowed year-round traversed the rest of the land, meandering across Aunt Myrtle's 400 acres and providing ample water for our stock. Our land, which included a mature growth of oak, hickory, pine, sweet gum, and a variety of other trees, adjoined Aunt Myrtle's property. On her land were 2 cleared, cultivatable fields of about 30 acres each. Mature woods covered the rest of the property. A wide pipeline right-of-way cut across all the land, which, because of its maintenance and mowing, grew a lot of grass that provided pasturage for the animals. The right-of-way also accommodated electric and telephone lines. A barbed wire fence enclosed the entire 420 acres and was a constant chore for us to repair and maintain. Doing things the way they were done while he was growing up enabled Paul to make our farm self-sufficient in many ways. We were still living as people did in the 1800s, although it was 100 years later. About 40 acres of the land were worked with the old mule, and later a gift horse named Dan, and hand plows to produce a great deal of our food, plus grain and fodder for the horses, cows, hogs, and chickens. The fields and wooded parts of the farm yielded squirrels, quail, and doves. Ducks and fish were easily obtainable from Black Bayou, only a couple of miles away. An occasional trip to Caddo Lake produced catches of white perch and brim. Our out-of-pocket expenses were minimal. Some lagniappe came from a boom in fur pelts. My brothers and I were able to get a couple of steel traps and set them out on the creeks running throughout our land. "There's a mink walking every creek in Louisiana," was a popular saying at the time, and an extra-large prime pelt would bring $35, a big sum for a youth, just for the fun of trapping. We never made such money with our too few traps, but we learned a lot about wildlife in our pursuit of mink, raccoon, and possum pelts. My developmental years also coincided with Paul's advancement in the oil fields as he progressed from roughneck driller, and tool pusher to drilling superintendent for a series of small companies. He was a good hand and in his prime. His skills were in enough demand to allow him to shift from job to job easily. When a company for which he was working idled its rigs, he would go to work for another that hadn't. But he still suffered occasional layoffs, which were sometimes prolonged enough to cause hardship. Granny complained that he always seemed to get laid off during duck season, enabling him to hunt more. He took it all in stride. His attitude could be summed up in a phrase he often used, "I was looking for a job when I got this one." There were lots of chores on the farm, with my older brothers doing the plowing and tending of the larger animals. Jimmy Frank did the milking, and Harold fed the hogs. The younger children fed the chickens and did the lighter work. Judy did most of her work inside, and the cooking experience she gained would be enhanced later with dishes such as jambalaya and white beans that she learned how to cook while living in South Louisiana. Growing up on the farm wasn't all work. We learned to have fun, too, and transformed our land into our own massive playground. In the front yard, we regularly spent hours playing a game we devised using a broomstick or a broken hoe handle for a bat and several discarded socks stuffed tightly into one another for a ball. The game was a combination of baseball and dodgeball. Once you hit the sock ball into play, it could be picked up and thrown at you. If you hadn't reached base or strayed too far from it and were hit with a sock ball, you were out. The rest of the rules were those of conventional baseball. Jimmy Frank, by virtue of being the eldest brother by 4 years, was umpire, coach, and general arbiter of play, not without some objections and arguments from his brothers and cousins. It was he who decided to let me bat left-handed, although I threw right-handed. He made all of my other brothers put the broomstick on their right shoulder. Granny's once attractive front yard, which was surrounded by several mature oak trees with rock wall flower beds around them, was turned into a beaten-down ball field with fairly large holes in the sandy soil around the bases, the result of years of my brothers and me and our friends and relatives sliding into them. Although my four brothers and I were usually enough for a pretty good game, frequently our friends such as Mac, John Paul, Marv Hobbs, Frankie Hale, or Kenny Tidwell joined us. Even Paul, Judy, and Jan were occasional participants. Our backyard served as a football field, complete with goalposts at one end, which Jimmy Frank and Harold made from a couple of oak tree uprights and a sweet gum crossbar. Remarkably, that football field ended up becoming the proving ground for several North Caddo High School Rebels and later Louisiana Tech University Bulldogs players. Our football field was bounded by a couple of big oak trees on the east, the log house on the north, the smokehouse and outhouse on the south, and a vegetable garden on the west. It was about 30 yards long and half as wide. We played two hands below the waist touch football year-round. Jimmy Frank, who played for the Vivian High School Warriors until it was consolidated into the North Caddo High School, always had a plentiful supply of footballs, old worn ones from his high school team. Jimmy Frank played center his freshman year, making first string when a player ahead of him quit school to join the Navy during the Korean conflict. Jimmy Frank was later moved to guard, then tackle, all 147 pounds of him, during his senior year, where he made second team all-district. Jimmy Frank played linebacker all 4 years. Players still played both offense and defense during those days, but he really wanted to be a quarterback. Since Jimmy Frank couldn't do it, he was going to make sure one of us would play in the backfield. Since we played on a short field in our backyard, each team had only four downs to score, or the ball went over. I remember Jimmy Frank slapping our hands when we missed a pass, and then smacking the ball into our belly and saying, "Catch it." Everyone learned to throw. I started passing when my hands were so small that I was unable to grip the ball fully and had to balance it on my palm. My brothers and our friends had varying abilities when it came to football. Tommy was the first to make quarterback, later converting to halfback to make room for me when I began playing for North Caddo High. Passing seemed to come naturally for me. Harold, who had a milk allergy and underwent two major operations while a child, suffered a broken elbow while playing freshman football and never played in high school. Silas was a hard-hitting defensive back for the Rebels. Tommy and I earned first-team, all-district football honors. As a senior, I was named first-team All-State quarterback and first-team All-District outfield in baseball. When I graduated from high school, I followed Tommy to Louisiana Tech in Ruston, Louisiana, on a full football scholarship. Tommy started as a wide receiver for Louisiana Tech, but was converted to cornerback his junior year. I sat on the sidelines my first year, then earned the starting quarterback job as a redshirt freshman the next year. Playing college football wouldn't have been nearly the same without having one of my brothers there with me. We were all intensely competitive, and this trait extended to all our activities, not just sports. We played for blood, whether it was Monopoly, dominoes, or card games. We showed no mercy, and tender-hearted Jan, who often cried in frustration, was not consoled, but ridiculed. In fact, we went out of our way to tease her and make her cry. Our competitiveness may have reached its peak in the waging of our corn cob wars. One side took up a position inside the barn, while the other attacked from outside. We used corn cobs, of which there were plenty in the barn, feed troughs, and the barnyard during the winter months. A hit from a corn cob below the waist rendered a player dead, and he had to withdraw from the game. When everyone on one side had been killed, the remaining players on the other side had won. Some little quirks in the game made it noteworthy. Although you could keep playing if a corn cob hit you above the waist, you had better not stick your head out from behind cover or you risked a knot on your noggin. You were fair game for a well-aimed cob, whether or not it killed you. Necessity also added another messy detail. In the late spring and summer, corn cobs became scarce around the barn, but there were always plenty of dried cow chips. These became legal missiles, too. If you found one that was crusted over enough to pick up but still soft on the inside, you were a force to be feared. We still laugh about a wet patty that got Jimmy Frank full in the face. Luckily, he was wearing his glasses. We also played a game in which we would wrench old, dried corn stalks from the ground and square off like sword fighters in a duel. One would hold his stalk out, and the other would strike and try to break it. If he failed, the other was required to hold his stalk out and let it be smashed. Whoever survived with an intact corn stalk, usually after repeated smashes, was the winner. I guess now I know why my sons are so darn competitive. They learned it from their father. My brothers and I spent our youth competing with each other outdoors. There weren't any Xbox 360 or Nintendo games to keep us occupied inside. I spent my youth exploring the fields, woods, and swamps that surrounded our home. My time out in nature shaped the rest of my life, and it's something I wanted to make sure my sons learned to enjoy. Whether it was hunting, fishing, or playing sports, my children were going to grow up outside. They weren't going to be sitting on the couch inside. At least they didn't grow up to be nerds. Chapter 3. Rise, Kill, and Eat. Rule number 3 for living happy, happy, happy. Learn to cook. It's better than eating slop. Here's a fact. Every human being on Earth has to eat or they will die. It's called starvation. You have to eat if you're a human being, whether you live in Monroe, Louisiana, or in some foreign land like Los Angeles or New York. There has to be a food supply, and you have to consume food or you're dead. It's an undeniable fact. Look it up. Not everyone likes to eat. These little chicks today are starving themselves to death, which is kind of ironic, but it's their choice. Since you have to eat to live, you're left with a dilemma. You can choose not to learn how to cook and just eat slop, and you'll stay alive. You can live off terrible cooking, which doesn't taste very good, but you'll somehow manage to survive. But my contention is that if you have to eat anyway, it just seems to me that you're shortchanging yourself if you don't learn how to cook. If you have to eat, why not learn how to eat well? Of course, the downside to eating well is that if you eat too much, you can't get through the door. Well, if that happens, you might ought to cut back some. You can overdo anything, and when you can't get through the door because you're too rotund, you might ought to say, I think I need to start eating a few salads. I'm not saying you should just shovel it in. I'm just saying if you learn how to cook, your stay on Earth might be more enjoyable. I learned to cook when I was young, and most of my meals started with something I killed. I have a God-given right to pursue happiness, and happiness to me is killing things, skinning them, plucking them, and then having a good meal. What makes me happy is going out and blowing a duck's head off. As it says in Acts 10:13, King James Version, "And there came a voice to him, 'Rise, Peter, kill and eat.'" Rise, kill, and eat. That's my modus operandi. When I was young, heaven to me was hunting in the woods around our house or fishing on the nearby lakes and rivers. We hunted and threw lines into the Red River for catfish and white perch nearly every day. We didn't have much of a choice. It's where we got our next meal. But when I was in high school, we were forced to move out of the log cabin where I grew up. My Aunt Myrtle sold the farm, so we moved to the nearby town of Dixie, Louisiana. The town was a nice enough place. We lived on Main Street, just a stone's throw from Stroud's General Store, which was adjoined by a one-room post office. The general store and a cotton gin were the only businesses in town. My father hoped the change of environment would help my mother, who had suffered a nervous breakdown and needed numerous trips to Shumpert Hospital in Shreveport, Louisiana, for treatment. Granny was diagnosed as manic depressive and was twice confined to the Louisiana Mental Institute at Pineville, where she received electric shock therapy, a treatment in vogue at the time. At times, my mother was almost her old self, and Paul would bring her home to be reunited with us. But her condition didn't stabilize until several years later, when it was discovered that lithium could control it. Fortunately, my mother went on to live a productive and venerated life until her death at 95 years old. Granny's illness couldn't have come at a worse time for my family. A short time after we moved to Dixie, Paul fell 18 feet off the floor of a drilling rig and landed on his head. The impact fractured two vertebrae in his back. As Paul collapsed forward, he was bent so severely that it burst his stomach. He also broke his big toe, which slammed into the ground as he doubled up. Telling us about it later, Paul said with a wry smile, "I've heard of people getting hit on the head hard enough to break both ankles, but not their big toe." The vertebrae in Paul's back were fused with bone from his hip. His stomach and big toe were repaired. But he was in a neck-to-hip heavy plaster of Paris cast for 2 years. A round opening had been left only over his injured stomach. As always, Paul met the situation in his own laid-back manner. Jimmy, Frank, and Harold were in college at Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge at the time. They were sharing a GI Bill payment of $110 a month and supplementing their income by Harold's work at the Hatcher Hall Cafeteria and Jimmy Frank's work on the LSU Horse and Sheep Unit Experimental Farm. They wanted to drop out of school and come home to work to help support the family, but my daddy insisted they stay in school, remarking dryly over the phone, "We'll make it." And we did, but not without hardship. Paul's disability payment from the state was $35 a week. In the late 1950s, that money went a little further than it does today, but not nearly far enough. Somehow, my family coped. With our mother sometimes away in the hospital, Paul was often left on his own with five children under his care. He was almost immobile at first, but within a few months, he was able to get around and help with the cooking. My sister Judy was a rock and did much of the cooking, though all of us helped, and she saw that Silas and Jan got off to school in good order. Fortunately, the school bus stopped in front of our house. To help make ends meet, Tommy and I gathered pecans and sold them for 35 cents a pound. In 3 hours, we could gather about 100 pounds, equaling the weekly disability payment. Tommy also cleaned the church building each week in Blanchard, Louisiana, where we worship, for $5 a week. With this money, he was able to pay for our school meals, which were 15 cents per day per child, thanks to Louisiana's liberal school lunch supplement. Our food staples became rice and beans, which we bought by the 100-pound sack. To this, we added cornbread. Our meager diet made fresh game and fish doubly appreciated. Fortunately, vegetables were cheap in a farming area, and we purchased what we could with our scanty means from the Biondos, an Italian family that had a commercial truck farm a few miles down the road. As I noted earlier, a real man can't survive without meat, so it was up to Tommy and me to find some. It wasn't easy because we no longer had acres and acres of bountiful land surrounding our home. There were plenty of farms around us, but the farmers in the area didn't want anyone on their land. They depended on it for their living and were diligent in warning off what they considered intruders. Tommy, Silas, and I often led the farmers on wild goose chases through the woods surrounding their plowed land. When the ground was wet, the red clay in the plowed fields would cling to our shoes and build up several inches in depth and pounds in weight. My only remedy was to stop occasionally, shake my leg vigorously to dislodge the mud, do the same with my other leg, and then continue on. Progression across the thick land was sometimes nothing more than 3 steps and a kick. We never considered what we were doing as poaching on someone else's land. We had our own code. We didn't bother any equipment, crops, or anything on someone else's farm. And I was always careful not to step on any young cotton or corn plants. But if it flew, grew wild, swam, or lived in trees, I figured that it belonged to whoever captured or gathered it. I might have even picked up a ripe watermelon. There were thousands of them out there every once in a while. Wouldn't have wanted it to be overlooked and get overripe. I can still remember my first encounter with a game warden. I was squirrel hunting out of season, my family had to eat, and I had a mess of them. It happened before I repented and was one of the reasons I needed to repent. When I squirrel hunted, I carried a big metal safety pin, and I sharpened its end so that it would run through the squirrel's legs right above the joint. If I saw a game warden, I'd drop the squirrels, close up the pen, and then take off running like the wind. On this occasion, I was wearing 2 pairs of old men's Argyle socks without any shoes and had my pant legs taped so they wouldn't flop when I was running. I was trying to be as quiet as possible. I was sitting there shooting squirrels when I sensed that someone was watching me. I couldn't see anybody and couldn't hear anybody, but I just had a feeling come over me that I was being stalked in the woods. Suddenly, I heard a stick break behind me, and I turned and saw a man standing there with a gun in his hand. He was wearing a wide-rimmed cowboy hat and identified himself as a game warden. He was standing about 20 yards from me. When I heard the stick break, I dropped the squirrels and they hit the ground. "Hold it, son," he told me. "I'm a game warden." "That's what I thought," I said. I was lean and mean and could run for miles. After the man identified himself as a game warden, I put it into high gear. For the first 100 yards, he was running with me. But I was grinning and thinking, this guy doesn't realize that he's not in good enough shape to be running with me. He was wearing cowboy boots and wasn't properly dressed to keep up with me. A buddy who had dropped me off earlier picked me up on the other side of the woods. When I was in high school, our basketball coach, Billy Wiggins, asked me if we were killing any squirrels. He said he wanted to go hunting with me as long as we weren't hunting on land that had been posted for no trespassing. "Of course not," I told him. "You'll be fine." Coach Wiggins and I went hunting right after daylight one morning, and it wasn't long before I heard a truck coming at a pretty good rate of speed. It was coming across a pecan orchard right toward us. The last 2 words Coach Wiggins heard were, "Run, Coach!" I took off running in the other direction. Moving to Dixie also introduced me to frog gigging. Some of the larger bullfrogs have legs bigger than chicken drumsticks and are delicious. We never ate frogs before moving to Dixie, but they were so abundant in the area that they eventually became part of our regular diet. In springtime, in less than an hour, we could gather up a large enough bunch to make a meal, even for a family as big as ours. The slough behind our house was overrun with frogs, as were many others just a short distance across the road. To catch them, we waited until dark and immobilized them by blinding them on the shoreline with a bright flashlight. One of us held the light, and another used a long-handled, spring-loaded clamp, or grab, to gig the frog. Some people called the clamps gigs, but the actual sharp-pronged gigs were illegal. The trick was to hit the frog sharply on the back, thus springing the grab and causing it to clamp around the frog, then to lift it out of the water or off the ground quickly so it couldn't use its powerful legs to leap free. During one particularly memorable frog gigging, we caught a tow sack full of the big ones, probably 30 or 40 pounds of them, so many that cleaning them was going